And there are Marmacomos at the edge of every row, in case you're walking in now. So welcome to Egg Donation in Jewish Law. I'm Michael Plout. I'm a junior in Yeshiva College, pre-dental bio major. And we're going to discuss in this session the medical and halachic aspects of egg donation, surrogacy, and gestational carrier. So Dr. Harry Lehman and Rabbi Dr. Richard Weiss are going to be speaking today. And Dr. Lehman will first present a case involving egg donation, and he'll go through the medical details. Dr. Lehman first studied here at Yeshiva University and received his MD at SUNY Health Science Center College of Medicine, otherwise known as Downstate. And he's currently the practice director of Montefiore's Institute for Reproductive Medicine and Health, and he's a professor in Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And I didn't know Dr. Lehman personally before this, but just from my correspondence with him in order to prepare for the session, I got the feeling that he's very dedicated to the field and to giving over his knowledge of medicine. And he was working on many conferences while working on this one, and it's a pleasure to have him. Then after Dr. Lehman presents the case, Rabbi Dr. Weiss will discuss it from the halachic standpoint. Rabbi Weiss received his smicha from Uritz here in YU, and then he received his MD from Wayne State University School of Medicine. I think it was in that order. So Rabbi Dr. Weiss is currently a professor of biology in Stern College, but he's also, it's proud for me to say, he's the Rav of my shul, the younger Israel of Hillcrest. And I do know Rabbi Weiss personally, and ever since he's entered Hillcrest, he's infused a jolt into the community with his by trying to make a personal relationship with everyone in the community, and it's an honor to introduce him as my Rav today. Please hold off on any questions. You can, if you don't want to forget them, you can write them down on the pad of paper, and at the end, there'll be 15 minutes of question and answer time. And without further ado, Dr. Lehman.
Thank you very much, Michael. This is actually a fairly exciting day for me. I have not been on this campus for a long, long time. I came here for one meeting and went to First Hall about two summers ago, but I have not been in these rooms and certainly Lamp Auditorium, as I mentioned earlier in the day. So it's been an exciting day. I promise you we will open the floor for questions. I didn't put the hammer on Dr. Grazi and Rabbi Brander as I was supposed to, but they had a lot of information they want to impart. Hopefully, Rabbi Weiss and I will get through the issues quickly enough, and I hope it's interesting that it does raise some questions. So the title of our talk is Are You My Mother? Egg Donation and the Gestational Carrier. And what we're going to try and do is list the goals. We're going to talk about some history when all this stuff started happening. I want you to get a sense of what the numbers are in the United States in terms of how many patients are actually taking advantage of donor egg and gestational carriers. I want you to understand the process. I think it's the biggest and most important part of the whole aspect of this conference is that we all understand physiology, the techniques, so that we know what we're talking about and we're communicating properly. I think that's the biggest issue that comes up is that people don't always know what the procedures are, and if we clarify those issues, obviously the halachic issues can be dealt with more appropriately. We're going to go through what the screening process is, just so you get a sense of that, what the procedures are, and at the end I have two case presentations, which I hope hones all the issues into one unit so that we could walk away with feeling good about our understanding of egg donation and gestational carriers. Okay, the first egg donation was reported actually in mammals in 1890 in London. Heap et al. In the Proceedings of the Reproductive Society of London, they described oocyte donation in rabbits. The first successful egg donation embryo transfer done in humans was done by Trounson, who's one of the forefathers of in vitro fertilization, reported in the British Medical Journal, and he had the first successful donor egg embryo transfer. It just so happens that Montefiore is actually the first site in the New York area to perform an egg donation successfully, and that was in 1985. It also started, we have Dr. Ash in the audience. She is part of the Reproductive Ethics Committee that meets at Einstein once a month. That ethics committee started because of this first egg donation cycle. And as I go through my talk, you'll get a sense that I really rely on the Reproductive Ethics Committee to help us make some decisions in our process when we go through these unusual unions between spouses and egg donors, etc. So how many cycles are done on an annual basis? What we are required to do at IVF centers is that we have to report to the CDC as well as an organization called SART. SART is the Society of Assisted Reproductive Technology. They're always a couple of years behind the stats. Right now, my lab is required to report the stats on November 15th for 2006 live births. It takes them about a year for those reports get out there, so hopefully in 2008, we'll have 2006 results. But in 2005, which are the latest results, we have 8,700, almost 9,000 fresh egg donor cycles with a 52% live birth rate per transfer. There were 4,500 women who used frozen egg donor transfers. That means that they had extra embryos during the initial IVF process, and there was a 31% delivery rate per transfer. Notice the difference in success rates between a fresh donor cycle of 52% versus a frozen egg donor cycle. Total procedures of assisted, ART stands for assisted reproductive technology, that are reported on an annual basis right now in 2005 is 123,200. So in that report to the CDC, to SART, in that year, those are the numbers that we had. There were about 350 sites across the country that report to SART. This is just a graph reported now from the CDC. Again, sort of the same report, but we have to report to two agencies. They're back in 2004. That's their latest report. To give you an idea of the percentage of ART cycles, again, assisted reproductive technology cycles using donor eggs by patient age. So if you look at the x-axis over here, patients' age are getting a little bit older. As you see, when you hit around 35, 36, you see a sudden upswing in the amount of cases or patients that are using egg donation, and this is percent on this side here. Again, from the same report, you have live births per transfer for each cycle using fresh embryos for one's own eggs versus donor eggs. Again, you can see the own eggs of the patients. They're in blue, with a light blue. As you hit around that 35-year-old mark, you can see there's a significant downswing in terms of success rates. And if you use donor eggs throughout all the ages, there's a pretty equal success rate throughout all that time frame. What is the cost to go through an egg donation cycle? The direct out-of-pocket cost for the recipient, that is the woman who's receiving those embryos, approximately $25,000 to $30,000. That includes the whole screening process, which is why I wanted you to get an understanding of what we're talking about. Compensation in the New York area, I can't speak for the whole country, but in New York, the amount is $8,500. So if a woman donates her eggs, she gets paid $8,500. And that's a whole other ethical issue that I'm sure we could spend a lot of time on. I know we want to get to some of the halachic issues, but is it proper for us to be paying egg donors as opposed to kidney transplant patients and paying for their kidneys? Whole other issue. There is no insurance coverage for any of the types of cycles that I'm talking about in terms of egg donation. So who needs egg donation? It's a good question. Patients who have premature ovarian failure. These are women who normally the time of menopause in this country is 52. You could argue that anyone who has menopause prior to 52, then they would have premature ovarian failure, but the number we usually use is 40. Any woman who has her period stop and no longer has eggs and she's less than 40 years of age, she has premature ovarian failure. It could be caused due to genetic issues, something called Turner syndrome, where there's a lack of an X chromosome. So there's only one X. They only have a 45 chromosome complement. You could have gonadal dysgenesis, which is a situation also. It's a genetic abnormality of the ovaries, typically also karyotypically abnormal. So genetically, the patients are abnormal. Typically, the women usually are usually infantile. They don't go through puberty because they don't have any function of their ovaries. So they're not making any of the estrogens that are required to get breast development. Surgical resection, if someone's required for whatever reasons to have a surgery performed and their ovaries are resected. Iatrogenic, I put down as patients who have cancer and have chemotherapy or radiation towards the pelvis, which would cause them to have lose their eggs at an earlier time. This is a very large category of patients who have autoimmune situations where they have premature ovarian failure. So patients can have antibodies towards their thyroid gland, antibodies towards their adrenal gland, antibodies to their ovaries. And it frequently comes in a grouping. So if you have thyroid disease or even diabetes, which could be autoimmune as well, those issues can lead to ovarian failure at some point in time. Other patients, and this is what we typically see more often, are women who are postmenopausal. They end up meeting their partners at a later time in life, and they make the decision to try to conceive and their ovarian function doesn't exist any longer. There are patients who have what we term in the fertility world diminished ovarian reserve. They do get regular cycles, but for some reason the quality of the egg is just not the same as it used to be. Patients who've gone through repeated in vitro fertilization cycles or IVF cycles and have not succeeded. And there are situations where if there's some kind of inheritable disease from the mom that perhaps you wouldn't want her to go through using her own eggs because she has some kind of genetic abnormality that she'll pass on to the next generation. So those are typically the broad spectrum of patients that would pursue an egg donor. The screening process is a little bit different for anonymous versus known donors. What I mean by anonymous, there are patients who we screen who are willing to be donors. The couples will never know who that woman is. And there are patients who come with known donors. There are patients who come with relatives or friends who are willing to donate their eggs to them. Patients who are known donors are typically presented to the Reproductive Ethics Committee. When we're doing anonymous donors, it's very easy to select who we want to be donors. And we do the screening from A to Z. When patients come with a family member, a mother wanting to carry the pregnancy for her daughter, situations like that, obviously those situations need to be presented to the ethics committee, and thus that's why we had our ethics committee established at Einstein many years ago. With extensive oversight and strict guidelines from the Department of Health and the FDA, the Department of Health and the FDA have the opportunity to walk into my laboratory in Hartsdale on a moment's notice. They have the ability to screen all my paperwork on patients who have been donors, and if any one of those pieces of paper is not accurate and does not have the testing that I need to have, they can close my lab. So those things keep us a little bit stressed, but they require a whole host of things that are needed in the donor history. There's a 26-page history form that we have to fill out for each donor that we screen. They have a whole host of infectious diseases, HIV, HTLV, gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, genetic diseases as well. So any kind of genetic disease that we can test for right now, and more are becoming available, we are required to do that testing. Genetic testing is typically the most expensive out of all the tests that we have, but it just keeps on making that bill higher and higher and higher. The last part we also make patients go through, both actually the donors and the recipients, is a psychological evaluation. The psychological evaluation for the recipient is typically just to make sure we're dealing with a responsible woman who we can rely on, who's going to have to be able to come to our offices frequently during 3 weeks of stimulation. And I'm going to get into the details of what a stimulation means so you have an appreciation of that. So the procedure is a little bit more complicated than your typical IVF cycle, and I'm going to show you some videos of what IVF's about so we clear that area. But you must synchronize donor and recipient cycles. Two women, two different cycling times in their life. There's some women who don't have cycles at all, so it makes it a little bit easier when you're dealing with a woman who's not getting her own menstrual cycle. But the recipient always, is always going to be, the donor is always going to be cycling. The recipient may not be. The donor undergoes controlled ovarian hypostimulation, which requires daily injections of hormones. That's what Dr. Grazi was talking about. He has some schematics of showing you when different injections start. So you have to have a situation where a woman's taking these injections. We monitor her every few days with blood tests and ultrasounds to make sure that they get a certain amount of growth on their ovary. So those little cysts or follicles containing the eggs get larger and larger and larger through time until they reach a mature state. And then we trigger ovulation. Meanwhile, the recipient has to be placed on a set of hormones that sort of keeps her into a holding pattern because we have to be prepared at any moment's notice that the donor is ready. You have to put the uterus in phase to allow the embryo to implant. So you have two women, eggs are being released. If it was in her own body, the uterus would have already made its lining prepared for the right time of the month because they had that nice schematic, again, or illustration of the embryos floating through the fallopian tube. It took about 7 days till it implants into the uterine wall. These two women are not doing the same thing at the same time. We have to put them in some kind of phase to allow that to happen. The donor goes through an egg retrieval, insemination of the eggs, and then the embryo transfer. This is what our little IVF OR looks like. There's a bed. This is an ultrasound. This is an anesthesia machine. This is our little table. It's a warm table. It's heated to body temperature. You can see test tubes here. This is not coming out so well in the light, but there's a little heated block as well over here so that the test tubes that I put in there also remain at a body temperature. This is one side of the IVF lab. This is a hood that also has a heated table coming across here. The microscope, which is being blocked by this, unfortunately, is built into the hood. These are some incubators. There's a centrifuge. This is a microscope. And we have a fairly small lab, but the embryologists like that lab being small because it doesn't mean that they have to walk with a tray, a petri dish of an embryo or sperm, whatever, to prevent accidents in terms of dropping things. So they like working in a small area, and they do a lot of their work on those hoods. This is actually the retrieval needle that we typically use. This is around 15 to 18 inches long, somewhere in that ballpark. It's connected to a little plastic tubing. This is a test tube, and there's some fluid in here to give you an idea of what the fluid looks like when we retrieve it. This is connected to the ultrasound machine, goes through the vaginal wall. Fluid gets aspirated because there's a vacuum system set up, and the test tube catches the fluid. This is an actual egg retrieval. And it's not working, guys. All right. I was going to show you an egg retrieval, but it's not. Yes? No? Nothing. Well, I had some very nice videos to show you. The egg retrieval, the needle actually goes into, it pierces the vaginal wall, and it goes into this cyst over here. And we do it in a systematic fashion, going from cyst to cyst to cyst. I wish you could see it, but the cyst actually collapses. The fluid gets aspirated into that fluid, and then we go to the next cyst and do the exact same thing over and over again. This is actually a great video of the actual insemination process. Let me see if this one works just by chance. Nothing. All right. So this process is we take about 50,000 sperm, dump it onto one egg, and it's the best one wins. That's in typical IVF where there's a large amount of sperm in the man, and you don't have any issues with those severe oligospermic patients that Dr. Grazi was talking about towards the end of his talk this morning. And let's see if it works. I'm going to bring it up individually. Okay. Stay here for a second. I have four in a row, then I'm done. All right, so you can see the needle coming in through the vaginal wall and how the cyst collapses. And the same thing's going to happen with the next. We're going to go down to this one over here. And you'll see we'll get into view. We make it a nice size that punctures the follicle, and the cyst is aspirated. That fluid gets trapped, handed off to my embryology team. They search for egg one, egg two for Mrs. Smith, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, we can stop. This one is the IVF one. No, wrong one. What's the one I'm gonna give it? It's this one here. Bring that one up. So this is what the insemination actually looks like. This is an ovum. It'll clear up. They're gonna go into high power in a couple of seconds. You're gonna see some. It's a pretty amazing picture. We dump, again, 50,000 sperm per egg. Each dish has its own little area for one egg at a time because we don't want to mix multiple eggs at a time. And the sperm is just attacking. This is the zona pellucida on the outside. It's just attacking it. And you're getting a sense that it's when we see these nice pictures, sometimes you only see it in two dimensions. But when we're playing with the objectives, you can sort of sense that it's actually it's a sphere. And there are sperm that are not only on the side, but they're also right over here as well. So it's a great picture. You can go to the next one. We're going to go to this one. So this is the ICSI procedure that Dr. Grazi was talking about earlier. You can see these are sperm that are actually all alive, these sperm, but we put them into a medium that slows the process down. You're going to see one sperm being picked up by this micro needle. This is a very, very small needle, and you're going to see the discrepancy in size, as Dr. Grazi mentioned earlier as well. When we take this into a different dish where the actual egg is. So this will take a little time. to get there, but we're going to change it right now. We're going to go to a different field. No, just stay where you are. It stopped. Okay. Yeah. Theoretically, it's possible. What they're doing is they actually hit the tails. They want to hit the DNA is sitting in the front of the sperm, in the head of the sperm, not the tail. So they actually hit the tails and they pull it in backwards. They don't want to try to slow it down by hitting the tails, not the head. So it is theoretically possible. All right. So let's get you to this one. Once we create the embryos. This is now in the dish. There are four embryos in this dish. You can see the magnitude size difference of the embryo transfer catheter. It's going to come into view in a second. It's going to pull up these few embryos that we have there. That's loading the embryos into the catheter. And then, need one more. I have one more video, and then we'll move on to the rest of the slideshow. We'll go on to this one. And this is what it looks like from the embryo transfer from the side. This is now an ultrasound of the uterus. There's a bladder over here. You're going to see a catheter come through the uterine canal. All the catheters are echogenic, so the ultrasounds could pick it up. It's going up to a point right about here, and you may see a little flash of fluid right there. It is. That was it. Those are the embryos being transferred. They're all, in this case, all four transferred at one time. We try to avoid transferring all four. We typically do two or three embryos, depending on age. Okay, so let's get back to the regular show. Okay, so those are the videos there. These are the different stages of the embryos. You saw these different stages earlier, so I won't belabor the point. This is just an egg on its own, zona pellucida, two pronuclei, which means one from mom, one from dad, then division process. The embryo here, as an interesting point, is totipotential. All the cells that are inside here, they're called blastomeres. Every single cell is equivalent. So if I were, again, theoretically, we're not allowed to do this, but if I were theoretically going to split all eight cells into individual dishes, I can make eight different individuals, all with the same genetic components. We're not allowed to do stuff like that, but that's what can happen. At this point, it's starting to differentiate, and this is called the blastocyst. This is the embryo transfer catheter, what it looks like from the outside when it's not in the patient. It's a coaxial catheter. It has an outer portion and an inner portion. This is a little bit more stiff than this is. This is almost like angel hair pasta. It's very flexible, very malleable, and that was what we use for the embryo transfer. You saw this video. You saw that video. Okay, so let's get to the case and then get to Rabbi Weiss in 2 seconds. Okay, this is a real case of a patient. She presented to me when she was 25 years old with Hodgkin's lymphoma. She came to me before she was getting treated for the Hodgkin's lymphoma because she wanted to talk about her fertility issues. That was very, very brave of her. A lot of people actually don't make it to our offices to do that. She also had a very good oncologist that was willing to let her do something about it before the process took place, before the radiation took place. Doesn't happen like that. Usually I get a call. I just found out my daughter has some kind of cancer. She's getting chemotherapy next week. What can you do, doctor? I give them all the options. The next thing they said, the oncologist said, I spoke to him, no way, we can't wait 2 weeks. We just have to take care of it now. This woman had some delay in that treatment. She needed radiation directed to her pelvis. She is able to get somewhat stimulated, not the full stimulation, ends up getting 4 eggs of her own. They retrieve 2 of them fertilized, and 2 of these embryos are cryopreserved for future use. She then goes and gets her treatment. She's healthy. She's now 5 years out of that treatment, so she's 30 years old at this point. 5 years later, she undergoes the frozen embryo transfer, and she fails to conceive. Took her some time to come to this conclusion, but she decides she really wants to have a family, and she and her husband make the decision, decide to move forward with a known donor. They choose the wife of a husband's best friend. These guys went to kindergarten together. They approached the couple and they said, would you do this for us? They would never have thought they would say yes, but they said 100% we'll do it. The particular donor is 36 years old and she already has 2 children of her own when she's donating. The donor undergoes that controlled ovarian hyperstimulation, the daily injections of the hormones. The recipient takes the hormones to prepare her uterus for that eventual embryo transfer. They obtain 12 eggs. 12 of them are fertilized with the husband's sperm, not the friend's sperm, but the husband's sperm. They transfer 2 embryos. She has 8 embryos cryopreserved at that time, and she ends up having an uncomplicated delivery of a singleton male child. She still has 8 embryos cryopreserved and returns 3 years later for a frozen embryo transfer. We don't have to see the couple's friend. We already have the embryos on ice in our lab. She has a successful transfer, has another son, and they have a true sibling. So it's a sibling of the donor egg with the genetics of the woman who donated the egg and her husband's sperm. They still have 5 embryos in our tanks for potential use. They now have to figure out what they're going to do with them if they don't want to try to conceive again. Dr. Reichman already put this up earlier. He didn't tell me he was going to use it, but he sent it to me via email. He said, this is a great slide. Use it for your talk. These are some of the issues that we're not really dealing with here in terms of the slippery slope issues. This seemed to be a nice case. I wanted to take a regular case that seems to happen very often. I can give you hundreds of cases of some unusual scenarios that are really nice to talk about, but are not the things that happen on a daily basis. This is more typical of what we're seeing in terms of egg donation, but not the people who said, let's get a smarter donor. That exists. It's out there. You can go to any internet website that's dealing with donor egg donation, and you will find people who have smarter egg donors, more beautiful egg donors, and you pay more money for it. It's out there. But that's not what we're talking about here, okay? So I raised some of the issues, and Rabbi Weiss will take over. If a Jewish woman has known pathology, can she marry? So if we know that, for example, she doesn't have a period and she doesn't have any eggs any longer, is she someone who's marriageable? Should the donors be Jewish or non-Jewish? Can a Jewish woman actually donate her eggs? And what is the status of the offspring within the Jewish community regarding kahuna, mamzerut? Does the husband fulfill his obligation of puruvu? What makes the child Jewish, the genes, the gestation, or just raising the child? And does the child have to convert? So those are specific issues related to donor. I put this down to be complete. Can you donate extra embryos to another couple? Can you donate for stem cell research? Can the frozen embryos be destroyed? And who has the rights to these embryos if couples divorce? So I'm going to step down at this point.
Can you go back to the slide and leave it up?
Okay. You want it?
I guess so.
Just the red dot. Okay.
Thank you. I've always wanted to use one of these. Thank you very much, Dr. Lehman, for a very comprehensive, very well presented overview of IVF, specifically focusing on egg donation. Just at the outset, just wanted to make just an extension of appreciation on Dr. Lehman's behalf and my behalf to the Yeshiva University, Stern College Medical Ethics Society. The truth is that we focused on their organizational skills. The truth is, though, that if you have the time and the privilege, there are publications put out by Yeshiva College and Stern College. I have a couple of them here from Stern College specifically because that's where I teach. Where you'll find lots of very wonderfully written articles by the students of Yeshiva University on a variety of topics of bioethics, medical ethics, including topics that we're discussing this whole day. So if you want to avail yourself of the students' perspectives and the research they've done, I certainly recommend it. At the outset, I just wanted to kind of set the tone, a few introductory comments regarding ART, assisted reproductive technology in general, and then focus more on the specifics that Dr. Lehman left up here on the slide that you see here in front of you. We'll go over those issues. First and foremost, I want to make the point that ART, assisted reproductive technology, from a bioethical and from a halachic perspective, is largely driven by psychological and emotional issues that are very important to take into consideration. Let me explain what I mean. We have talked a lot today, you've heard a lot about specific halachic analyses, various sources in the Gemara and the Talmud and others, and we'll discuss some of that here as well. But one of the most, perhaps, the single most potent driving force, when you look in the poskim, when you look in the rabbinic decisors, as they analyze these issues, the common theme that recurs is the sensitivity to human beings. The concern for a couple that is struggling, that is frustrated, that is angry, that is in pain, that is the single most important driving force for very well thought out, very articulate decisions that you find in extensive literature. Dr. Reichman referred to his website where you'll find lots of that literature, but when you look in the poskim, that's what you find. And it's very important to understand that in halacha, halacha doesn't exist in a vacuum. Halacha exists in the context of human involvement and human endeavor. Just to quote from you very briefly from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein in an article that he wrote in Tradition, where he talks about the concept of hora'ah. Just to kind of preface some of the comments, nothing that I'm going to say today is considered to be definitive halacha. I don't want to project that. We're going to discuss some of the halachic views. I don't want anyone to leave here assuming that anything I say is necessarily cast in stone. Any individual case needs to be exactly that, addressed individually. But hora'ah, namely Jewish legal decisions, are comprised of two elements, Rav Lichtenstein writes. One is psak and one is psika. Psak means the formulation of law, the analysis based on text, based on logic, based on hardcore, very, very diligent analyses. So the second is psika. Psika means, as he puts it, in the only way that Lichtenstein can write, I can't write that way, I can hardly read this way, but psika, by contrast, denominates implementation. It bespeaks the application of what has already been forged in the crucible of the learning experience to a particular situation. To explain that a little bit more, he writes later that illustrations apart, however, the cogency and legitimacy of a human approach to psak appears to many problematic. Namely, to say that, well, for one couple, one might issue a certain halachic decision, and to another couple, others, because of human differences or emotional, psychological, or dynamic differences between the two. Says Rav Lichtenstein, there are those who might be opposed to that. There are those who say this is what the halacha states. There are poskim who do prohibit significant parts of assisted reproductive technology, not just egg donor. We're talking about starting from artificial insemination through in vitro fertilization without any donors. There are poskim, there are rabbinic sizers who are very much opposed to these procedures. Rav Lichtenstein is suggesting that the final psak with proper analysis has to take into consideration the human component. And as he puts it, as anyone who has been privileged to observe Gedolim, the great leaders of psak and halacha and Judaism at close, attest that they approach psak decisions doubly animated by responsibility to halacha and sensitivity to human concerns. Not infrequently, couples refer to me for rabbinic consultation. There are times that I have felt in my own mind, speaking to a particular couple, saying to myself, why don't they just pursue egg donation? You hear the frustration. They've engaged in numerous IVF cycles with failure, as Dr. Lehman had on one of the slides, one of the indications. And I'm saying to myself, why don't they? Why, based on the discussions, why don't they? And what I'm failing to recognize is that they're not ready. This particular couple may not ready. It may be the husband who's not ready for egg donation. It may be the woman who's not ready for egg donation. One has to very much incorporate the psychological and emotional elements in experiencing infertility and in having them to perhaps engage in procedures that themselves can be very, very frustrating, very psychologically draining, very painful at times. And therefore, one has to always be sensitive to the human component. When one looks, for example, in the psukim, in the early psukim written decades ago by Rav Moshe Feinstein, where he talks about hazra malachutit, when he talks about artificial insemination. So when he talks about artificial insemination, one of the points that he makes about permitting artificial insemination in certain contexts, in certain instances, the parameters of which we don't need to get into, he uses the term that is permissible with the following in mind, umitstarim me'od behishtoka kum levlad, that a couple is truly in anguish in their desire to have a child. That is what drives Rav Moshe's tshuvas. If you look in Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's discussions, he also talks about this notion of a fact of the context of trying to enhance a relationship. By that I mean that you have a couple and they have fertility is clearly a stress within the marriage itself, and that's something that also has to be highlighted. Fertility is a tremendous stress on a relationship between a husband and a wife. And therefore, part of the goal in trying to be sensitive to the human component is understanding that the infertility, if it persists, can continue to be a stress on that relationship. Now, it must be pointed out that success in fertility is not a substitute for a good relationship. And the better the husband-wife relationship is, the more likely that the ability to succeed will exist as well. There's a beautiful medrash that I don't want to discuss here, but found in the beginning of Shir HaShirim Rabbah. It talks about a couple that was unable to conceive, unable to have a child, and they decided, therefore, to get divorced. And the whole description in the Medrash about how they, in a sense, neglected each other, how, in a sense, they didn't view the greatest asset that they each have in life, namely the other. So their husband-wife spousal relationship, that's why, to the best of my knowledge, every ART clinic has on staff a psychologist to be able to help couples in a variety of ways. This is a very important point. Second important point, introductory, is that all of the discussions that we have today, earlier, later, and now, revolve around whether a particular procedure is prohibited, or whether a particular procedure is permitted, and the ramifications of that. There is no discussion about whether these procedures are obligatory. That seems to be universally the view of all the rabbinic decisors, that there is no mandate, there is no obligation for a couple to engage in assisted reproductive technology if they choose not to. And a couple shouldn't feel compelled, either by external forces or internal forces, to seek such. The basis for that is a very halachic analysis. In Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch Code of Jewish Law discusses the fact that in order to secure a mitzvah saseh, a positive commandment, which the mitzvah of peru or revu, being able to procreate and multiply and have children, is a positive commandment. The Shulchan Aruch says that for any positive commandment, even a positive commandment that's a mitzvah overis, that has an expiration date, for which if I wait too long, I will not be able to succeed, I am not obligated vazveis hon rav. I'm not obligated to incur a significant expense. So in Shulchan Aruch, the discussion is about esrog. We just finished the holiday of Sukkot. So I don't have to go to enormous expense to secure an esrog. If it means that I will not hold or shake an esrog all of Sukkot, it doesn't matter. I'm not obligated to incur an inordinate expense. So based on that idea, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes very clearly, and others as well, that a couple is not obligated. They shouldn't feel compelled. It should come from within their own desire, not based on familial pressures or any other external pressures. It should come from within the couple that they want to pursue ART, not because they have any obligation. Once they decide to, the question then becomes, is it permitted, is it prohibited? And if it is permitted, do they fulfill a mitzvah that they were not obligated to pursue in this context? Those introductory remarks aside, I'd like to try to address some of the specific issues that Dr. Lehman left for us on the slide. We'll assume for the moment that IVF is permissible. Again, as I alluded to before, not every rabbinic opinion concurs with that. There are rabbinic opinions who would very much be opposed to most of perhaps what we're discussing during this day because of, in large part, the issue of hatsoah zera levatala, wasting of seed. When a male has to procure a sample, a sperm sample, a semen sample, for purposes of evaluation, for purposes of being used in artificial insemination, for purposes of being used in vitro fertilization, either with his wife's egg or with a donor egg, that is a subject of extensive, that was perhaps the single most greatest obstacle to assisted reproductive technology, namely working out an analysis of how it is permissible for a Jewish man to express semen, to express sperm, not in the context of intercourse, and be able to do so in a way that will not be used within the normal reproductive tract of his wife to try to conceive. So that was a major obstacle. It is at present not a major obstacle, because certainly the overwhelming opinion of the poskim is that for purposes number one, of trying to achieve and fulfill the mitzvah, which the couple is not obligated to, but in trying to achieve that mitzvah nonetheless at their own discretion of peru or vu, of trying to fulfill the mitzvah of having children, that itself, by definition, defines the process of sperm procurement as not levatola, not in waste, because it is going for a particularly positive purpose, namely, first and foremost, peru or vu, having children, trying to fulfill the mitzvah. In fact, that concept of peru or vu is so dominant, it's so important, that for some poskim, it is the all and end all of deciding whether a particular procedure is permitted or not. So, for example, if we assume, Rabbi Brander alluded to this a little bit at the end of his discussion, the last session, if we assume that if a husband's sperm fertilizes his wife's egg in vitro, in a petri dish, and that embryo is then transferred back into his wife's uterus. Dr. Lehman diagrammed and described for you. If we assume that that child that is born from that process is considered to be the child that is related to both that mother and that father, that man and wife, if we assume so, then many poskim are of the opinion that they fulfill a mitzvah of peru urevu, that they fulfill the mitzvah, even though the child was not generated through normal intercourse, and therefore the process being one of a little bit of an unordinary or extraordinary process, nonetheless, many assume that that does fulfill the mitzvah of peru urevu, even though it wasn't in the normal context. Not everyone agrees to that. Tzitz Eliezer is of the opinion that when you aspirate oocytes from a woman, since the oocytes are normally, physiologically and anatomically designed to remain in her ovaries and in her body until she ovulates, and then they go to the fallopian tube and then to the uterus, aspirating them out of the body, Tzitz Eliezer is of the opinion, not only detaches the oocyte from the mother anatomically, it also severs the relationship between that oocyte and the mother. Therefore, he suggests that that oocyte is no longer related to the mother, is no longer related to the woman, and therefore it's not her offspring, potentially, that she gives birth to. By a man, we assume for sure that it could be, or at least more likely it is, because normally, physiologically, a man always is involved in generating sperm that are disengaged or removed from his body. But for a woman, that's not the norm, and therefore, the Tzitz Eliezer suggests that perhaps the oocyte is no longer considered related. That is a minority opinion. Most poskim assume that the egg still is considered related to the woman from whom it was aspirated. The sperm is certainly related to the husband, and they engage in vitro fertilization. Even though they did not generate this child through normal processes, nonetheless, many assume one fulfills the mitzvah of peru urevu. Rav Ovadia Yosef has a long tshuva where he talks about that as well, and that's how we generally it's assumed. So if we assume that one fulfills the mitzvah of peru urevu that way, let's now go to the donor. If a woman is able to carry a pregnancy, but not able to produce eggs or eggs of viable quality, and so some other woman will donate her eggs, those eggs will be fertilized by the wife's husband and then transferred into the woman. So question number one, does the husband, does the wife, does the couple fulfill the mitzvah of peru urevu? So there are some poskim who are of the opinion that because of peru urevu, the only type of donor that is permitted, this is the opinion, for example, of Rav David Cohn, in Big Posek in Brooklyn, in Flatbush, highly regarded throughout the world, throughout the United States for sure. Rav David Cohn's opinion is that to implement donor egg with a combination of IVF with the husband's sperm, the donor must be first and foremost Jewish. If the donor is not Jewish, then the husband potentially does not fulfill the mitzvah of peru urevu, because his sperm is fertilizing a non-Jewish egg. And so the question of being able to fulfill peru urevu comes into high question because of the fact that the combination here is not between a Jewish man and a Jewish woman. It's between a Jewish man and a non-Jewish woman. So therefore, he says, the only way one is permitted to engage in donor egg is by using a Jewish donor, and therefore the husband is guaranteed, according to his opinion, of fulfilling peru urevu. Now let's go a step further. The child is born from the mother, so to kind of mix things and integrate them and make them a little bit perhaps even more confusing and hopefully make it clear by the time we're done. If the child is born, you'll ask me, well, who is the mother of the child? So the answer to that question is, as is discussed by many poskim, and that is the consensus, that we don't really know. Yes, probably more poskim, Rabbi Brander alluded to it and discussed it a little bit. Yes, most poskim would assume that the mother is defined by gestation, or perhaps more specifically by delivery. Just parenthetically, there's an interesting discussion. Rav Yosef Engel, one of the great Achronim, discusses based on the Gemara, the Talmudic passage in Maseches Megillah. Not too far from Purim. So the Megillah describes by Esther that ki ein lo av aim v'mos avia v'ima l'kachom Mordechai lo levas, that Esther had no father, no mother, and Mordechai adopted her. So the Gemara says that when she was conceived, her father died, and when she was born, her mother died. And Rashi there explains, Rav Yosef Engel highlights, that according to the way Rashi presents it, it would seem that paternity is defined by the moment of conception, and maternity is defined by the moment of delivery. And that Rashi says that Esther never had a father, because he died before conception occurred, and she never had a mother, because she died in labor, and so in a sense, she really never had a father or a mother because of the fact that they died before they could be labeled as such. So many are of the opinion, it's not unanimous, many are of the opinion that maternity is defined at the time of delivery and therefore would be defined by the mother who undergoes parturition, namely the process of delivery, the gestational mother, and therefore the donor mother would not be considered the mother. But that's not unanimous. And because it's not unanimous, many poskim, like Rizalman and Nehemiah Goldberg in Eretz Yisrael, is of the opinion, that's how many poskim, and that's the general approach of the Rabbinical Council of America as well, that one has to be concerned that perhaps the mother is not defined by gestation and delivery, but defined by the genetic donor. And therefore, because of that, now, with that in mind, with that, if you will, ambiguity in mind, in place, because there are not definitive. It's important to understand that probably, not for a long time, if ever, will anyone ever be able to definitively resolve these issues in a way that's categorical. Because you can try to extrapolate from Gemaras one way or the other, but the Gemara has never addressed these scenarios because these scenarios never existed. You can try to deduce and induce and extrapolate and analyze and try to figure out, but there is no one Gemara that will definitively resolve this issue. So presumably for the foreseeable future, the definition of maternity will remain a discussion, a dispute, majority of which is of the opinion that it's based on delivery or gestation, a minority, but an important minority based on genetics. And as a result, if you have a donor egg and the wife is the one who's going to deliver, there's a discussion, dispute, whether the mother is considered to be the genetic origin or whether it's considered to be the gestational or the mother of delivery. So with that in mind now, going back to our scenario, so Rav David Cohn says that if the donor is Jewish, and obviously the wife is Jewish, then there's no question about the identity of the child. And the child is Jewish regardless. Both the genetic contributor and the gestational carrier are Jewish. Therefore, there's no question about the identity. Therefore, there's no need for any conversion. Therefore, the husband fulfills Peru or Avu one way or another because the child is Jewish. The child is related to him, and therefore he fulfills Peru Urvu, and Peru Urvu is the guiding force or the driving force to permit these. However, if you take a non-Jewish donor, like if you pursue anonymous donors, and based on Sukkim of Ramosh and others in other situations, we would assume, even in New York, that by majority probability, anonymous donors would be non-Jewish. So if a husband's sperm fertilizes an anonymous donor's egg, then that anonymous donor presumably is not Jewish. The gestational mother is Jewish. The child is born. Is the child considered to be the child of the genetic non-Jewish mother? Which means the child is not Jewish, which means the child has no relationship to the gestational mother and has no relationship to the father, which means the father doesn't fulfill Peru Revu, which therefore complicates whether the father was permitted to engage in this to begin with because he procured sperm for what purpose? He's not fulfilling Peru Revu. What's the justification for it? Therefore, says Rav David Cohn, that's why some suggest this way, if you have a situation of egg donor, it should be Jewish. It should also be a single woman, not a married woman. So if you're going to use a relative, relatives, in the case that Dr. Lehman described, it was a friend who was married. So if the donor is married, that creates another complication. Why is that? Well, there is a concept of mamzerus. Mamzerus means that a child, bastard child, meaning a child born out of a relationship that's illicit, that has a certain severity of it in the Torah, chai v'krisus, but be it as it may, so if a man has a relationship with a married woman, the child is considered to be a mamzer or a mamzerus. And that has serious implications for the child. Now, in vitro fertilization and an egg donor, there is no physical contact between the husband and the donor. So there is no prohibition that they have violated. But is it possible to still create a mamzer, a child that is considered to be a bastard child, maybe born from a prohibited relationship that perhaps didn't involve a prohibition? Is it still possible to create such a child that would have the status of a mamzer? So that if the donor is Jewish and married, and the husband's sperm fertilizes that donor who's Jewish and married egg, perhaps, therefore, if the child is considered to be related to the donor, then the child would be considered to be a mamzer. So you'll say, well, how can you create a mamzer if there is no intercourse, there's no iser? So the answer is, that too is a machlokus, that too is a dispute. Most poskim assume that you can't create this kind of prohibited child, this mamzer, from not having a prohibited act. But there is a minority opinion. Brander referred to the journal Noam. So in that edition that he referred to, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a very long essay where he suggests that it's possible for a mamzer to be created even without a prohibited act having been involved. And therefore, his opinion is that at least misafek, out of potential doubt, the child born, let's say, from artificial insemination by a Jewish man's donor sperm into a Jewish married woman would potentially create mamzerus, potentially. Therefore, in this situation, if the donor is a Jewish woman and she's married and the husband's sperm fertilizes, the potential for mamzerus is potentially there, and therefore, Rav David Cohen's opinion is Jewish woman single, not mamzerus. Others are of the opinion otherwise. This is the opinion of Rav Schechter that you'll hear from later on, as well as others, that the actual preference is to use a donor who's not Jewish rather than a donor who's Jewish. The disadvantage of using a non-Jewish donor is that the child's identity is obscure, because if the genetic contributor is not Jewish, then the child may be not Jewish. If the gestational mother is Jewish, maybe the child is Jewish. So that's obscure. So that's why it is the opinion of the Rabbinical Council of America, and I've had the privilege of being on Beis Din occasionally when this came about, where there was an egg donor situation, non-Jewish egg donor, husband's sperm fertilized, transferred back into the wife, had a child, and as a result of that, the child is born. Is the child Jewish or is the child not Jewish? That's subject to a dispute that we referred to. Because of that dispute, from a non-Jewish, we undergo a procedure of gerus, of converting that child, misafek, out of doubt. We don't make a bracha over the gerus, over the conversion, because it's a safek. So we undergo a process of conversion. I've had the privilege of being present in some of those procedures. And the issue that came up once was the fact that the father was a Kohen. And therefore it came up, that's what Dr. Lehman refers to here in terms of kahuna, issues like that. So again, based on possibilities, again, if the donor is not Jewish, could be the child's not Jewish, which means the child's not related to the father, which means the child's not a Kohen. If the gestational mother is considered to be the mother, then the child is Jewish, the child is related to the father, the child is a Kohen, so on and so forth. So again, because of having to satisfy both very serious opinions, we do allow the child to get an aliyah, for example, as the first Kohen. We tell him that he's not permitted, if he's a male, so he's not permitted to marry a grusha, a divorcee. Rav Gedalia Schwartz's opinion, the Av Bezner of the RCA, is the child should not go up to Duchen, should not be a Nosi Kapayim. Others may have a different opinion, but that's the opinion of the RCA and Rav Gedalia Schwartz, just to kind of illustrate some of the issues that come up in that regard. Why would one suggest that it's preferable to use a non-Jewish donor? So the answer to that is, and the reason for that is, because with a Jewish donor, there is one serious problem. See, with a Jewish donor, you'll say, well, you fulfilled Purim Urvut, the child will be Jewish, there are no issues, everything is fine, except for one problem. There is what's called as Gzer Shemayisa Bas Achoso. That is to say that now you have a child who's definitely Jewish, is either the child of this gestational mother or is the child of the donor mother. Well, that donor mother has other children. And what if, pray tell, this child born from the gestational mother who received an embryo fertilized by her husband, fertilizing this woman who's Jewish, her egg. What if this child, pray tell, meets a man or a woman? Let's say this is a man. Let's say he grows up and he meets a woman who happens to be the daughter of this donor woman from her husband. So they're half brother and half sister. What if they fall in love and they want to get married? So that's an incestuous relationship of half brother, half sister. So that's a gzer shemayisa bas achos. Through why Moshe and his chuvas and the early chuvas did not permit artificial insemination by a Jewish man because of the concern that the child, that's one of the reasons, because of the concern that the child that's generated from this artificial insemination may marry a half offspring from a half sibling from another, from the donor and result in an incestuous relationship. So that's a problem with the Jewish donor approach. That's why some suggest the best approach is to use a non-Jewish. Because non-Jewish, there's no relationship between the child that's born after Geirus, after conversion, and any children that the non-Jewish donor has. So that's an advantage to non-Jewish donor. The bottom line is that there are advantages to both. And I think, considering the human component, and I should really stop to allow Dr. Lehman to go on or to take questions, that's why the human component is very important. Because there, my feeling is, based on a little bit of experience, not enough to this point, but a little bit of experience, that for some couples, the Jewish donor may be the proper approach. And for some couples, the non-Jewish donor may be the proper approach. And that one has to kind of consider the situation in all of that. Let me just see, conversion we talked about, genetics we talked about. In the handout, just to tell you what's in the handout, there's a wonderful discussion by Dr. Halpern. In the Hebrew text, there's some specific issues that were posed to Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, and I'll just conclude with one of those, because he was asked, would you recommend to a couple to engage in... this was surrogacy, so I can put that aside. I don't have to say anything more. I'll come back to Dr. Lehman if you want to take questions. I appreciate your attention, and... thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. That was excellent. We've spoken together before, by the way. We've done this a couple of times now. He's much better now. Yeah. So we're both matured and seasoned now because we've done it a couple of times. So I'm going to try and go through this very quickly. I do want two more minutes just to help you understand differences between what we just talked about, which is egg donation, surrogacy, and gestational carriers. And then what I'm going to do is I have a slide I'm going to leave up at the end so that we're all clear what we're talking about when the questions come up. Traditional or natural surrogacy, this is something that is just lots of problems in the medical literature. Most of the stuff that I try to look up, they're mostly law cases in law journals. When you go on the Medlines, you're finding law cases about all kinds of issues. This is where a woman is inseminated and she delivers the baby for another couple. The surrogate is the genetic mother, and she's also the gestational mother. So that's something that's very, very rarely used these days. The gestational carrier is a woman who carries the pregnancy from another woman. She is not donating any of the genetic component. She's renting her womb, and she has the intention of handing over the delivered child to the genetic mother. No one talks about when the first natural or traditional surrogacy was ever done. I don't think people wanted it to be put into the books as the first ones that did that. And it was probably going on for many, many years in the past, but no one knew about it. This is the biggest case that's been out there, the Mary Beth Whitehead case in Baby M. This was a William Stern had his sperm inseminated into Mary Beth Whitehead, delivers Baby M 9 months later, and she claims it's her baby. So that's the biggest case that was out there years and years ago, and the courts actually settled that it was initially, it was the Stearns' baby went back to Mary Beth Whitehead in the appellate court, and eventually the Stearns got the baby back years later. The first gestational carrier report, 1988. Again, the SART report, there are only, out of those 123,000 cases, there are only 731 gestational carriers performed, at least that are reported in this country. Why would one do that? There's a situation of Mullerian agenesis where it's called Rokitansky-Kuster-Hauster syndrome. There's no formation of the uterus in utero. They have ovaries but no uterus. The genes are totally normal. The external phenotype, what the appearance of the female is totally normal, it's just they lack a uterus. People who require hysterectomy, Asherman syndrome is another syndrome where the inside of the uterus, the lining of the uterus has been harmed for some reason, either related to multiple miscarriages or terminations of pregnancies, or people who have fibroids, which are muscle tumors in the uterus. Cost, $50,000 to $100,000. That's in states where they're allowed to broker to find a donor. In New York, you can't do that. In New York, there are all kinds of laws that the gestational carrier, whoever delivers the baby, is the mom of the baby. We advise patients not to keep gestational carriers in New York because if she delivers the baby, she could walk away with the baby technically. So you can make all these nice contracts that are developed, and we recommend similar screening to the egg donation screening. We recommend presenting to the Reproductive Ethics Committee. It's illegal to broker the relationship. If a patient comes in with a known carrier for us, that's okay. All patients should require reproductive attorneys, but just everyone should know that those cases are not binding in the state. I wanted to go through a case. I don't think I have a lot of time for that. It just happened to be an interesting patient who tried her own IVF several times. She had 3 pregnancies on her own. She lost those pregnancies. Her uterus was a little scarred. She had adenomyosis and fibroids, which are 2 different types of pathology, plus the scarring. She still tried to get pregnant after we repaired her uterus twice, 2 different times. It didn't work. She had 5 embryos left that were frozen. She used her husband's brother's wife, so her sister-in-law. She used her sister-in-law. She gets 17 eggs initially. She had 5 embryos that were frozen. She uses her own sister-in-law who has 2 kids already. And then she ends up having 3 embryos transferred to her sister-in-law. She delivers twins, and the genetic mother and father don't get the baby because the sister-in-law decided that these twins are mine. I carried them. I had a cesarean section. They're my baby. So it ended up having a very big court case in New York related to that. I had to write all kinds of affidavits trying to prove to the court who the father was, who the mother was, because I had all the original documentation telling me where the sperm and egg came from. Eventually, it took them about 10 months, but the babies did go back to the genetic parents, not the gestational carrier. But that was an unusual situation. So I raised the same issues again, halachically. Again, if a Jewish woman has known pathology, can she marry? Should it be a Jewish, non-Jewish carrier? A lot of these things have been addressed. So I'm going to open up to questions. What I'm going to do, though, is that I put up this little slide just defining the differences between the 3 different groups of people who we're talking about. So egg donation, this is husband A with sperm. It's his genetics. It's the uterus of his wife. She has gestation but no genetics. The donor gives over the egg, so there's genetics there but no gestation. Traditional surrogacy, mom has nothing to do with this at all in terms of the biological component of it. She does not have genetics. She does not have the gestation. The surrogate is carrying the baby, and it's also she's giving over her own genes, husband's sperm again. The gestational carry, which is a more common situation than the traditional surrogate, sperm is from the husband, eggs from the wife, but the uterus is a third party. So I'm going to leave that up there, and I think we're going to. Do you have other things that you want to talk about before we open up questions, or are you?
Maybe we'll open up if people ask, then I can.
So, any questions that?
Could you wait for me to hand you the microphone, and please speak into the microphone. It's going to be recorded. Do you have a question?
Hi, just a quick question. Everything that was mentioned earlier halachically, would it apply to the third situation where it's mom's egg, dad's sperm into a carry? Yeah, the issue, who is the mother, gestational or genetic mom? But aside from that machlokas, would the third one open up all of the major issues that, let's say, the first two would, where you have a donor's egg?
The answer is essentially that would be the starting point, namely that you would, start with the similar issues, namely you have to be able to justify the sperm procurement. So that would then be based, according to some, on the issue of pru revu. That would then result in similar issues and identity issues. So again, you have a similar situation. Here the egg is coming from the wife. So she's the genetic contributor in this case. And the gestational one is the carrier. So you will have similar issues. So if the gestational carrier is not Jewish, you again will have an identity issue, except in this case, most of the opinions will be that the child is not Jewish and would need a conversion. If the gestational carrier is Jewish but married, you again have an issue that potentially, according to some, creates an issue of mamzer. If the gestational carrier is single Jewish, then you've kind of obviated those issues. What is complicated about this is that it is, which you'll find in the secular ethics literature as well, you'll find a tremendous discomfort with going beyond the immediate husband and wife. With a donor, the egg is fertilized, but there isn't really a third person who is so physically involved. Now you have a kind of triad, you have a triangle. It's not just that someone donated a cell. You have actually a third person involved. You have a third outside party that is carrying it. You have the wife who gave her egg and the husband, and they're going to take that child. So you've created a triangle. So in the general ethics literature, you'll find discomfort, and in the Jewish perspectives as well, of the integrity of the marriage, integrity of relationship, kind of bringing a third person into it in such a, if you will, intimate way, which is different than an egg donor, where certainly if the egg donor is anonymous, but even in this case, where you have someone who is literally very physically, intimately involved. So there's discomfort. Is it absolutely prohibited? So in discussions of Zalman Chaim Goldberg, he said, just to reiterate, you have to be concerned that the genetic mother and or the gestational mother is the mother. But he was asked the following, so just to kind of highlight it. Imisha charedit, if a religious Orthodox woman, chashucho yiladim, is without children, unable to have children, is she permitted to implement this process of bringing a child into the world through what's known as Eim Pundaka'it? Pundak is a motel or a hotel. That's a Hebrew term, a Talmudic term. And that is the term that is used now halachically to describe a surrogate mother, Eim Pundak. She is basically housing the child like a hotel or like a motel. And this woman comes to Rav, so what would you say, what would you recommend? So his opinion is, Im atalich pipikuach, if it's done with proper supervision and proper parameters, amlitz, I would recommend. If the family, again, dynamic is such, they have no children. But contrast that to the next question he was asked, what if a family has one child and they, let's say, experience secondary infertility? They had a child normally and then they experience secondary infertility after having been successful initially and they want to have another child, which is a very common. Dr. Lehman probably can tell you approximately how many of his patients are not patients who have never had children, but who have had one and are looking to have a second or a third, wherever it may be. So in that case, he says, I would not, at least a priori, recommend that procedure, because this procedure is sensitive in terms of some of the, if you will, ethical issues, in terms of the halachic issues, it's complicated. So to recommend such a procedure when the parents already have one child, I wouldn't a priori. You have to kind of think about it a little bit more. And that there's a significant difference, at least in this case, between a family that already has one child versus a family that doesn't have any children.
You mentioned that a couple's not obligated to do artificial reproductive technology due to the expense. But what about in countries, I think in Israel, where the medicine socialized and they don't pay anything to...
Okay. Yes, that's a very good question. So I probably should have been more precise before, so I'm happy that you raised the question. The concept of hon rav not only refers to out-of-pocket expense, but it involves any kind of extraordinary measures. The concept is not limited to a monetary issue, but doing anything out of the ordinary to secure a mitzvah is not obligated upon me. That's, I think, Rabbi Bleich develops this idea in one of his articles in, I don't remember what context exactly, but the idea is that to fulfill this mitzvah, I say, I'm not obligated to engage in the emotional, not only the expense, the emotional, the hormonal changes, all of the things that are involved in this process are beyond the scope of what's considered mandatory. If I decide to choose so then many procedures are definitely permitted by many poskim, but it's not just the monetary, it's the whole process. So thank you for clarifying that.
I was just curious about the first question that had been up there. If a woman has known pathology, is it forbidden to marry her, or is it forbidden for her to marry?
I'll give you just one. These are things that happened in the office. I had a Hasidic family come to me one time with their daughter who actually had Rokitansky-Kuster-Hauser syndrome and wanted me to sign in a letter that she could have children. I mean, that's, you know, it's a difficult question. It's a difficult question, and you're going to address it, not me.
I agree. It's a difficult question. That's when, so she has no,
uterus. She has Mullerian agenesis, so she has no uterus at all.
So Rav Avadya Yosef has a tshuva. Rav Avadya Yosef, former chief rabbi of Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, but still one of the greatest Sephardic poskim and one of the greatest poskim in the world. So he has, in Yabia Omer, in his Shalosh Tshuvos, he has a discussion about a woman who, I think his specific case, that there was surgical resection of the uterus, and whether or not there is a prohibition between herself and her husband engaging in intercourse. Because by definition, the zera, the hotzar zera, will be levatola, won't have any potential of generating a child. So he points out in his own unique way of quoting and quoting and quoting, which I can honestly tell you I did not read from beginning to end. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to come here this day today because I'd still be reading. But he put the bottom line is that he points out that that's not considered to be any issue of hotzar zera levatola. As long as a couple engages in normal intercourse, whether or not that intercourse can or cannot lead due to either physiologic or anatomical constraints, as long as the intercourse is normal. If there's some kind of contraceptive being used, that's a different issue, which is not the discussion of our topic here. But as long as a couple engages in normal intercourse, then the potential for conception or not does not dictate whether the intercourse is normal, and that's why he says, therefore, there's certainly no prohibition, absolutely none at all, for this woman to be married. There's no, in any womb, there's no blemish that exists. There are some male blemishes that exist, perhaps, for certain testicular diseases or certain anatomical, but this kind of anatomical, either agenesis or resection, would not in any way render the woman any less marriageable halachically or philosophically. There is a stigma that Dr. Lehman is referring to, and that bespeaks the situation that he just described, which is a very important issue that needs to be perhaps handled psychologically rather than medically or halachically.
There's a Rabbi Jacobowitz who goes around to fertility centers trying to find out which doctors do certain procedures best. And he sat down with me. He actually tells me that he tries to actually make shidduchim with couples if they know the husband or the future husband had some kind of testicular injury, doesn't have, and known not to have sperm, and he'll try to arrange marriages between these women who also have complications. So he tries to get around that completely and avoid the issue. But it's certainly an option.
The other issue, which is implicit, which we don't want to get, is the question of disclosure. Namely, if a young man or young woman have a certain disease, how much or what does a person have to disclose? That's a different issue for a different country.
In the Rokitansky case, you said,
yeah.
The question is if they have one successful gestational carrier, are they allowed to have a second? Or are you limiting them to just the one child?
So the Rokitansky, so usually it's very hard to find a carrier to do the same thing for you a second time. Is that you're suggesting? So you're not going to have a true gestational sibling. Genetically, it's still the mother's. Is that the scenario? I want to clarify.
The scenario is basically, you know, it's a true gestational carrier. A relative is carrying, you know, the patient has no uterus. A relative carries the pregnancy for them the first time, but you mentioned that if someone already has a child in secondary infertility, then they couldn't do it a second time. So in this case, are you, you know, before you even get started, you're limiting them to one child, because once they have a child, you can't do it again.
Okay, so Rizalman Nechemia Goldberg that I quoted before, and thank you for the question again for clarification, does not say categorically they can't. Just that, as opposed to, let's say, primary infertility, one would certainly be more easily motivated in recommending or allowing a couple to pursue, let's say, gestational carrier than in the case of secondary infertility, where they already have a child. One would have to be, in a sense, not more deliberate, but would have to then kind of approach it from a different perspective. The conclusion may be the same. In one of the tshuvas, I think Dr. Abraham Nishmas Avram quotes from Shlomo Zalman, if I'm not mistaken, that, well, what if a couple has two or three children? But some couples want to have more children. And for some women, or some husbands, or some couples, the emotional stress, the emotional pain, not having the ability to have a third or a fourth or a fifth child is very powerful. So that's why Rosh Hashanah Zalman says, well, you know, generally speaking, we're going to permit assisted reproductive technologies with certain parameters and certain guidelines because parents don't have one child or they don't have the fulfillment, let's say, approval of having two children. But to have three or four or five, what's the permit? But he says, but when you're dealing with emotions, you have to take that into consideration, coming back to one of my original points. So you can't categorically say, Rezan Lechem and Golgir is saying that you can't just jump to say that this is permitted, therefore if gestational carrier is permitted, it's permitted always. One has to then be a little bit more deliberate and address the issues, and perhaps it might be, okay, and what you though you talked about, though, a family member, though that would be a little problematic, because then again you're getting into the issue, potentially, at least according to Rosh Hashanah Zalman and others, that Ramoshi even addresses in his tshuvas, of the potentially of, again, mamzerus, potentially, of or illicit of women who are illicit in terms of their potential relationship with the husband, and therefore, even though they're not engaging in an illicit act, the child may still be considered an illicitly generated child, even though there was no isser. That is a minority opinion, but it's a very important opinion, and it's a suffix that Rosh Hashanah Zalman raises, and therefore can't be easily dismissed.
Okay, this is going to be the last question, but if you have any questions, I'm sure Rabbi Weiss and Dr. Lehman would be happy to answer them after the session.
Yes, I wanted to find out in the category of egg donation if, according to Rav David Cohen, who advocates having a Jewish woman to donate her her egg, how do they answer the objection about the possible gzera of her half-brother, half-sister?
Okay. It's a very good question. So the answer to that, in other words, the question is, we introduced that there is a rabbinic injunction that prohibits generating half, if you will, siblings that don't know about each other or won't be aware of each other, and therefore potentially, though it's not a high statistical probability, but it is a potential, and it's something that Rav Moshe takes very seriously and other posts can take very seriously. Therefore, having a Jewish donor who, if one assumes that the child born is related to the donor, and that donor has, let's say, her own children, the potential of consanguineous relationships might be. So how do you address that issue? So Rav David Cohen's opinion is, which is a very beautiful thought, and if you find it in the general ethics literature as well, the notion of a registry, that you would register such children with, let's say, the Rabbinical Council of America, for example, just as an example, and when that child would then grow up, which brings in a whole other issue psychologically of disclosing to the child where the child's origins are from, that aside. But you would then, let's say, be able to contact the registry and find out if the child is being recommended to a particular young man or young woman, is there any records of relationships and that whether or not the donor is that other family or not. Even if you keep things anonymous and keep confidentiality, you can have a registry under the guidance and supervision of an organization that can keep records and then kind of cross-reference and determine the appropriateness of it. It's a very good question.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi Weiss and Dr. Lehman. If everyone could please move over to the building we started in, Lamport Auditorium. Next session is going to start at 3:30, and there are light refreshments. And remember to pick up your headsets if you ordered them for the Hebrew session.
Yes.
And feel free to take home the packets.
Embryos don't.